100% supporter of Maduro. I've got my criticisms. But I think that these writers who are on the left are committing two errors. One is they fail to contextualize what is happening. They're critical, and they're not in support of U.S. military intervention, and they wouldn't support the attempts to overthrow Chavez, for instance, but they don't make the connection between this hostility and aggression on the part of a disloyal opposition in Venezuela.
That's Steve Elner, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Steve Elner on the open veins of Venezuela. Historically, Venezuela has been an ATM machine for U.S. corporations. Located on the northern coast of South America with a population of 32 million, Venezuela is rich in natural resources: diamonds, bauxite, gold, iron ore, natural gas, and oil, especially oil. The election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 heralded in what he called the Bolivarian Revolution. It was a challenge to U.S. hegemony. After his death in 2013, he was succeeded by Nicolas Maduro, who stood for election in that same year and won. Maduro was reelected in 2018. The economy is in crisis. There is runaway inflation in the country today. Supermarket shelves are empty. Many people have left for neighboring countries. The Venezuelan economy is being crippled by sanctions imposed by the U.S., Canada, and other countries. Ordinary Venezuelans are suffering. Washington is leading the charge for regime change in Venezuela. To talk about Venezuela is Steve Elner. He's taught economic history and political science in Venezuela for many years. His articles have appeared in major newspapers and journals. He's the author of Rethinking Venezuelan Politics, Class Conflict and the Chavez Phenomenon, and Latin America's Radical Left. He spoke in Seattle.
The situation in Venezuela has been very precarious, but more recently, even more so. The recent statement by John Bolton about the axis of evil consists of Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. Just there's an escalation of discourse, an escalation of the narrative, but also an escalation of the actions. Just think of Obama's actions against Venezuela in the form of an executive decree that stated that Venezuela was an extraordinary and unusual threat to U.S. national security. That was issued in 2015. It was reissued by Obama a year later, and now reissued by Trump. But now the economic sanctions against Venezuela means that the rhetoric is being escalated, but also the actions are being escalated. The Trump administration states that Venezuela is a dictatorship. The only way to justify these sanctions and the only way to justify possible military action, which Trump has stated is an option, it's on the table, and has also encouraged the Venezuelan military to overthrow President Maduro. Trump said a military coup against Maduro would succeed. Well, in effect, that's saying that a military coup or that military coup leaders can count on U.S. support. The only way that can be justified is not by talking about the economic crisis, because if that was the criteria for military intervention, then the United States would be intervening all over the place, which in fact it does, at least in the Middle East. But it would be even worse. I mean, it would be intervening in Central America and Africa, all over the place. So that the typical narrative of the Trump administration and the Venezuelan opposition and much of the media, the corporate media, is conflating talk of the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, the difficult economic situation, which, although is sometimes exaggerated, not by much, because the situation in Venezuela is very difficult. and nobody denies that. They conflate that with the state of Venezuelan democracy, that there's no democracy, that Maduro is a dictator, and that there is constant violation of human rights. So the question is, why, if the part about the economic crisis is true, why do they have to lie? Or why do they have to exaggerate? Why do they have to cherry pick when it comes to Venezuelan democracy? Well, it's just that. If it's just about economics, you can't justify sanctions. You can't justify military action. But by conflating the two, they confuse people because they say something that's basically true, that the economic situation is difficult, and then they insert the part about democracy quickly. And if somebody isn't analytical, if they're not really, you know, analyzing the message, they kind of assume that if the part about democracy is true, then what they're saying about dictatorship and violation of human rights must also be true. But the fallacy of the statement that Venezuela is not democratic can easily be pointed out. Firstly, James Carter and his Carter Center have observed over 90 elections throughout the world. Carter stated that of these 90-plus elections, that Venezuela has the best electoral system. There's no question about it, because the Venezuelan system, unlike the United States that is being highly questioned now because of possibilities of hacking and fraud, etc., the Venezuelan system is a dual system. And I have voted. I'm a resident in Venezuela. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm a resident in Venezuela. And I have the right to vote in municipal elections and now, with the Constitution of 1999, in state elections. I can't vote at the national level. And I'll tell you how it works. You go in there and you vote electronically and a paper ballot comes out with the candidates that you voted for. You look at that paper ballot, and if those are the people that you voted for, you sign it and you put it in the ballot box. If there's any discrepancy, well, that will be reported. So if there's hacking or if there's, you know, messing around with codes, it's going to come out. The voter is going to see with his or her own eyes that these aren't the people that they voted for. And there is an auditing process of almost 50% of the voting centers. The opposition is there as observers, as they have a right to be. And there's never any objection. They sign the document stating that, you know, everything was in order. So the opposition sometimes, not often, but sometimes they talk about electoral fraud. But their definition of electoral fraud is different than mine, which is okay, because you can define a word however you like. My definition of electoral fraud is with regard to the counting of votes. If there are discrepancies, if the final tally doesn't represent the way people voted, that's electoral fraud, and that country can be considered non-democratic. When the opposition, the few times that they use the term electoral fraud, they're referring to something else. They're referring to, for instance, that you don't have a level playing field because the government television channel, which is supposed to run so many ads for the opposition candidates, run less ads or there's less time than what the Electoral Council has ordered. That may be true, it may be false, I don't know. But even if it's true, that's not electoral fraud. That means that there are certain shortcomings in the system. Okay, in the worst of cases, I'm not saying that it's true, but even if it were true, look at the United States system. I don't have to even go into that. Gerrymandering, voter suppression. Not only two of the last three presidential candidates who have won elections with less votes, Bush in 2000 and Trump in 2016. Not only that, but, you know, in national elections for Congress, The Democrats almost always win. The Democrats almost always get more popular votes. So there are fallacies, there are shortcomings in all electoral systems. But electoral fraud in Venezuela, there is no real evidence of that. Another thing that the opposition says is that there are cases of people voting twice. But they talked about that with regard to the elections in November of 2017, the gubernatorial elections. In those elections, the Chavistas won in all but five states. And in all of the states in which the Chavistas won, with one exception, they won by 10 or 15 percentage points difference. Now, you can't alter an election by sending people out to vote two times or three times or four times. The opposition has enough resources. They're getting it from the United States. They're getting it from their own business class, which opposes the Chavista governments. They tried to overthrow Chavez twice, the Chamber of Commerce of Venezuela. They have enough resources. If, you know, they were sending people out to vote two, three, five, ten times, the opposition would be able to, you know, snap a couple of photographs, and that would be in all the newspapers throughout the world. There was a student at a place that I talked at in Canada at Thompson River University, a Venezuelan student, who said, when I voted, I saw somebody who I know who had passed away, and his name was down there in the book, and I saw the signature. I know from experience that when you're talking and somebody says something that you know is a lie, not to call him a liar. And I didn't make any comment about in that respect, but I did say what I just said, that that's not going to alter the results when the difference is, you know, 15,000, 20,000, 50,000 votes, getting people to vote in the name of somebody who's passed away is not going to alter the results. That's what I said. What I didn't say is that I don't believe what he said, because I know how that works. Somebody cannot go in there and start examining the books with the names of the different voters and their signatures. I mean, you go in there and you sign. And the possibility that somebody that you know has their signature next to yours when you go to sign is 1 in 10,000. So, okay. Then the real question that comes up is, if you don't have electoral fraud, how do you explain that the Chavistas have won all the elections since 1998, and there have been over 20, and the Chavistas have won all but two? They lost one. It was a referendum in 2007. They lost by 1 or 2 percentage points. Chavez immediately announced that the opposition won those elections. He was angry, but he announced that his people lost. And the second time was under Maduro in the elections for the General Assembly in 2015. So the Chavistas have won all the elections, except two. Now, you could talk about populism, you could talk about demagoguery, and say a candidate can win an election once by being a populist, but the second time, if they don't deliver, they're going to lose. I mean, that happened to, por ejemplo, Alejandro Toledo. He made more promises than he had to, and he won those elections. And then, you know, when I was in Peru, the first time his popularity was down to 8%. And the second time, people were talking that his popularity had improved because it had reached double digits. It had gone from 8 to 10%. So the explanation that cheap populism explains Chavez's ability to win elections so many times doesn't cut ice. In order to understand that, you have to go back to the period of neoliberalism in the 1990s. In the 1990s, the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez and Rafael Caldera privatized. There was a massive privatization, as there was throughout Latin America. But unlike other countries in Latin America, in Venezuela, all the privatizations, practically without exception, went over to foreign capital. The state-owned steel company was bought out by an international consortium, Argentinian-controlled. The electricity company or companies, the electricity company of Caracas was bought out by a U.S. company. The telephone industry was bought by GTT, which was in turn bought by Verizon. So Verizon owned the Venezuelan telephone company, and a number of other industries. And companies that were owned by national capital, such as the cement company, which was owned by Eugenio Mendoza, who was the Rockefeller of Venezuela, the richest person in Venezuela. He died in the 1980s, and I think in the late 1980s, if I remember correctly, it was bought out by a Japanese firm and then Cemex. They were the owners of the main cement company, Vencemos, in Venezuela. The two of the most important banks in Venezuela, El Banco Provincial, which I think might have been the biggest, was bought by Bilbao Vizcaya of Spain. The oldest bank, the Bank of Venezuela, Banco de Venezuela, was bought by Santander, also of Spain. Savoy, which was the pride of Venezuela, it's the chocolate company, and Venezuela makes perhaps the best chocolate in the world. It was a company that was founded by European immigrants that arrived in Venezuela around the end of World War II. Well, that was bought out by Nestle. So you had, industry by industry. The Venezuelan economy ceased to be Venezuela in the 1990s. And Chavez comes along with a nationalistic discourse, which I realize that, there's certain words which in Venezuela have different connotations. I use the word nationalistic. And then I thought, here in the United States, people, nationalism, that's not necessarily good. But then I said, now that Trump is calling himself a nationalist, the word is kosher, and it shouldn't get anybody upset. So there was a sense of economic nationalism that, the Venezuelan economy had been turned over to foreign capital. And that helps explain why an outsider like Chavez won the elections. And not only an outsider, as opposed to one of the traditional parties that might have been, critical and expressing the discontent that existed in Venezuela, but a party that had been around and was more pro-establishment. Chavez was an outsider. He had spearheaded a coup that had failed. He went to jail for that for a little over two years. And not only did Chavez win those elections, but the candidate that came in second place, Enrique Salas Romer, also had an anti-party discourse. He was pro-establishment, but his discourse was anti-party, and he came in second place with about 38% of the vote. And Irene Saiz, who had been a Miss Universe, and became the mayor of one of the cities in Caracas, she was in first place in the beginning of the campaign until she accepted the support of COPEI, a traditional party, and then her support nosedived. So there was a lot of discontent in Venezuela. And the people in the opposition and the opposition leaders who you might, hear on TV or read in the press, who say Venezuela was a nice place to live before Chavez came along. People lived well, hunky-dory. Everybody was content. And incidentally, part of that narrative is that we didn't have racism before Chavez came along. But Chavez used the racist card and has now divided people of color and people who are white. That never existed before. That discourse is blatantly false. The part about racism, I can recommend a book by Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, Winthrop Wright, Café con Leche. Café con Leche means basically that Venezuelans are a mixture of white, African, American, and there's also an indigenous component that Chavez was quite proud of. that he was part indigenous, part African, Venezuelan, and part European. But that's a myth, that racism didn't exist. As a matter of fact, I can say that one of the things that, when I arrived to Venezuela in the 70s, there were a group of U.S. PhD students. And it's something we all picked up. I mean, I heard from all the students, boy, you know, Venezuelans, they're hesitant to go to the beach. They don't want to get tanned. Since people in the United States are more sensitive to that issue, they'd always make that comment, you know, the Venezuelans say that there's no racism in Venezuela. Why do they think twice before going to the beach? That kind of thing. So racism, in more subtle form than, say, in the States, but racism existed in Venezuela. And as far as Venezuela being some kind of social, economic paradise, I mean, the election of Chavez as an outsider is a demonstration of the fact that there was a lot of discontent. The second point that I want to go over very, very briefly is the system of severance payment. But we're here in a building of organized labor, and it's worth pointing out that in Venezuela, the system of severance payment has always been extremely important. It's a basic right. Everybody in Venezuela knows what prestaciones sociales means, which is the severance payment system, based on your last salary, your last monthly salary. Well, that system was eliminated by the same president who, at the age of 20 years old in 1936, wrote the labor law of 1936 that established that system. He destroyed his own baby. The labor reform of 1997 was written by a former communist, a former socialist, Teodoro Petkov. He was in the government, and Petkov wrote the reform that eliminated the system that had existed before, which the labor movement stated 2 or 3 years before that they were not willing to even discuss the change of the reform that was being proposed. And they changed. The labor movement, the labor leaders, practically all of them, went along with the neoliberal reform. And Chavez, who was just beginning his campaign for the 1998 elections, was with the workers. He participated in a very big march. I'll tell you, there was a real divide between the labor leadership that supported that reform and all the workers who were opposed to it. So that Chavez is elected. And the first thing he does is he puts a halt to the privatization. Aluminum was about to be privatized, and he put that on hold. The Social Security system was about to be privatized. He put that on hold. And then, after he was reelected for the third time in 2006, he nationalized those companies that had been turned over to foreign capital. He nationalized the telephone company from Verizon. He nationalized the steel company. He nationalized the electricity company. He nationalized the cement company. He took over the Bank of Venezuela. So this was something that explains not only why Chavez was elected in the first place, but why he maintained his popularity throughout those years. Secondly, in 2001, he passed legislation that, in a sense, partially nationalized the oil industry. Because that legislation, in October of 2001, stated that all mixed companies involved in the primary exploitation of oil had to be more than 50% owned by the state. Previously, the process known as the oil opening, the apertura petrolera in the 1990s, the neoliberalism of the 1990s, similar to Mexico, it was a gradual privatization. And that reform, that law, known as the Ley Orgánica de Hidrocarburos, meant that all these companies were state-controlled, state-owned, in more than 50%. And at the same time, simultaneously, a land reform known as La Reforma, La Ley de Tierras, basically stated that the private sector had certain rights, but also obligations. And one of the obligations was the exploitation of the land, and that idle land would be taken over, would be subject to state takeover. Now, in the past, in Venezuela, almost every time that an agrarian reform was promulgated, you had a coup. You had a coup in 1945, when Medina Angarita, a very popular president, was about to pass an agrarian reform that was written by his Secretary of Agriculture, Minister of Agriculture, Angel Biagini, who was going to be the next president of Venezuela. Well, you had a coup shortly after that. In 1948, same thing. Agrarian reform, President Romulo Gallegos, famous novelist, he was overthrown just right after an agrarian reform was written. And Chavez, right after his agrarian reform was passed, in October of 2001, you had a general strike, which is a misnomer because it wasn't a general strike. It was a general lockout because it wasn't the labor leaders who they supported. The traditional labor leaders supported it. But when you have a situation in which the workers go to work and the gates are closed, the doors are closed, that's not a strike. That's a lockout. And it was the Chamber of Commerce of Venezuela, known as FEDECOMINAS, which really spearheaded that general strike on December 10th, 2001. And on April 9th, 2002, the same thing happened. And then they called for the extension of that general strike on April 10th, and that led into the coup on April 11th. And who was the president for those 2 days before the poor people came down from the hills and Chavez was reinstalled as president? The Chamber of Commerce. The president of Venezuela was Pedro Carmona, who's the president of FEDECOMINAS. And the same thing happened 7 or 8 months later in December. You had a 2-month general lockout. The same scenario. The labor leader said, you know, we're calling a strike, but it was the president of FEDECOMINAS, this time Carlos Fernandez, who spearheaded that. And that failed. So this I think gives you a background. Firstly, as to why Chavez was so popular. And secondly, it helps explain why Maduro is so popular. Because even though the economic situation in Venezuela is very difficult, and that has a lot to do with the price of oil declining so rapidly from over $100 a barrel to a little over $30 a barrel, and that's inevitable. Venezuela is as dependent on oil as any country can be on their main export commodity. Oil exporting countries in the third world tend to be more dependent on oil than other countries are on their main exports. So that was inevitable. But in addition to that, Maduro has had to face an international environment quite different from that of Chavez. Because Chavez, during that period, you had these pink-tied governments, which were progressive, some more than others, but you had Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, then more recently El Salvador. All those countries were run by progressive governments, whereas Maduro faces a situation which is just the opposite. Governments that are aggressively opposed to the Maduro government. So in spite of that, Maduro has not reversed Chavez's policies. He hasn't turned to neoliberalism. He hasn't privatized these companies that were taken over by Chavez. This partly explains the fact that the Chavistas have maintained power for this extended period of time.
You're listening to Steve Elner, The Open Veins of Venezuela. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
Now, the other development that explains the difficulties of the Maduro government is that under Chavez, as hostile as President Bush was and Obama was, at first it seemed like Obama was going to be friendly with Chavez. They met in Trinidad. Chavez gave him a copy of The Open Veins in Latin America by Eduardo Galeano. Remember, there was the front page picture in the New York Times was the two of them embracing each other, and it looked like things would be different, but they weren't. The deep state got to Obama. He was quite hostile to Maduro, but on the one hand, Obama set the stage for what Trump is doing with that executive order. On the other hand, Obama didn't go as far as Trump, because Trump has played an activist role in isolating Venezuela. Of all the important members of the Trump administration, the one that has had the most nefarious effect is Mnuchin. Because what Steve Mnuchin has done has been to use the list of Venezuelans who are being sanctioned. That is, Trump has a list and he keeps on placing more names on it. Of Venezuelan, for the most part, government officials who are accused of corruption and money laundering and drug trafficking without any proof, no right to defense. And so their deposits, their millions of dollars that they have robbed from the Venezuelan people and have placed in U.S. banks. I know at least one person is laughing when I say these things sarcastically, because this is what Trump says, that these thieves in Venezuela are depositing their millions of dollars in U.S. banks. I've got news for Trump. Maduro isn't that stupid. If he's robbing from the Venezuelan people, he's not going to be placing that money in, you know, savings accounts in the United States. But this is what Mnuchin is saying. Mnuchin and the people in the Secretary of Treasury are saying, we're going to find out, I mean, practically quoting him word for word, we're going to find out where Maduro and Cecilia Flores, who is the first lady, where they have their money, and we're going to freeze that money. Then they talk about shell companies. They talk about front companies, which Maduro and his cronies are working through. Now, it's laughable, but it's part of a really nefarious and very effective strategy, because it creates an atmosphere in which U.S. companies are afraid to have anything to do with Venezuelans. Venezuelans, members of the government, Venezuelan business people who might be pro-government, and Venezuelan business people who are anti-government. But when the president of the United States says that, you know, there are people who have, you know, corrupt people in the Venezuelan government who have money in the United States, and we don't know where that money is, but we're going to track this down, and when we track it down, we're going to freeze this money, because that's what they say. We're going to freeze these funds. So what effect does that have? That makes financial institutions in the United States very reluctant to handle any money coming from Venezuela. But not only in the United States. Look at what's happening in the case of Iran. The sanctions just went into effect. And already, Shell and Total is the biggest oil company in France. And even though the European Union countries are not in agreement with Trump's sanctions against Iran, because they support the treaty that Obama signed with Iran, nevertheless, these two companies have stated that they are not going to import oil from Iran, because they don't want to have any retaliation against them. In other words, they are afraid that the United States may take measures against them if they don't respect Trump's sanctions against Iran. And not only that, SWIFT, a European financial institution, has stated, and you can look this up and you can Google SWIFT, Iran, sanctions, those three key words should pull up the article. in which SWIFT says that they will not handle money from banks in Iran because we don't want, and I'm practically quoting what they say, we don't want to create instability in the world financial system. In other words, European institutions are afraid to buck the Trump administration because they fear reprisals. So if this is affecting Iran, it's affecting Venezuela as well. Okay? Now, in addition to that, the sanctions explicitly state that U.S. financial institutions, that nobody in the United States can purchase bonds from Venezuela. This executive order goes beyond U.S. borders because banks throughout the world are complying with this measure of the Trump administration. Venezuela is trying to refinance its debt. Any country does that. All countries do that when they're facing economic difficulties. And because of the price of oil and because of other circumstances, including these sanctions and including the economic war against Venezuela, which is a term that the Maduro people use, it's natural that Venezuela would try to refinance the public debt. But the Trump administration is making this extremely difficult. In addition to that, the Trump administration has prohibited the oil company Citgo, which is 100% owned by Venezuela. It was bought out by Venezuela in the 1980s, and now Citgo cannot send profits back to the home country. So according to Joe Emmersberger, who does good empirical study, I mean, he's writes on Venezuela, and he claims that $1 billion of profits have not been sent back to Venezuela, that the Venezuelan government has been deprived of $1 billion since this measure went into effect over a year ago. These are some of the effects of the embargo. The critics of the Chavista governments on the right use what's happening in Venezuela as proof that socialism doesn't work. What they don't say is that if socialism doesn't work, why every time a socialist government is established, going back to the Soviet Revolution of 1917, why do the big economic groups and why do the governments of the capitalist nations do everything possible to undermine those governments to create instability and military intervention? That was the case with the Soviet Union. It was the case with China. I mean, after all, the United States didn't recognize China for all those years. Certainly the case with Cuba, with the invasion of the Bay of Pigs and all the attempts to assassinate Castro and all the other instances of sabotage. But also, it doesn't account for the fact that Venezuela isn't socialist. I mean, if socialism doesn't work, perhaps this demonstrates that capitalism doesn't work, because 80% of the Venezuelan economy is capitalist. It's not socialist. The government is committed to socialism, but the economic system continues to be capitalistic. The argument of writers, both academic writers and analysts on the left, basically they state, making a generalization, that they're opposed to the sanctions. They're certainly opposed to military intervention. If they're on the left side of the political spectrum, they're not going to support any of those measures. But their argument is that Venezuela and other so-called pink-tide countries, the progressive countries like Argentina and Brazil, have not succeeded in breaking dependence on the basic commodities that those countries export. It's called the neo-extractivism thesis. It means that these countries are as dependent on extractivist commodities such as hydrocarbons, in the case of Bolivia, Ecuador, and Venezuela, soybeans, in the case of Argentina and Brazil and Uruguay, and Bolivia to a certain extent also, that this dependence continues. And so these countries, these governments have been failures. They're right with regard to this shortcoming, and it's one of the shortcomings. I am myself critical of certain aspects of these governments. I'm not a 100% supporter of Maduro. I've got my criticisms. But I think that these writers who are on the left are committing two errors. One is they fail to contextualize what is happening. They're critical, and they're not in support of U.S. military intervention, and they wouldn't support the attempts to overthrow Chavez, for instance, but they don't make the connection between this hostility and aggression on the part of a disloyal opposition in Venezuela. Because the political scientists who refer to make a distinction between loyal and disloyal opposition, the disloyal opposition is the opposition that does not recognize the legitimacy of the government. And the Venezuelan opposition since 2001, since that legislation that I mentioned before of the agrarian reform and the oil legislation, has not recognized the legitimacy. They've tried to overthrow the government on several occasions. They've promoted demonstrations that have paralyzed cities for 4 months in 2014 and 2017 that resulted in confrontations. There were excesses of the security forces, but also armed confrontations in which six National Guardsmen were killed in 2004. Imagine if that had happened in the United States. You know, a student at that university, the same student that I mentioned before, said, okay, six National Guardsmen were killed and one or two policemen in 2014. But that was retaliation. That was retaliation. That was the term that he used. The protesters retaliated. Well, here in the United States, if you have a demonstration, and let's say the police use tear gas, I know all about that from the 1960s, the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s. I mean, I saw that all the time. But let's say somebody pulled out a gun and shot a policeman. What would have happened? This is what happened in 2014. In 2017, these demonstrators, who the New York Times compared with Martin Luther King, because the demonstrations were civil disobedience. And they compared Leopoldo López, the main leader of the demonstrations in 2014, with Martin Luther King. Well, Martin Luther King never paralyzed cities for 4 months at a time, building barricades, fires, placing big boulders on the streets. None of those demonstrations, at least that I saw, were on sidewalks. They were all on the streets, paralyzing traffic. Almost all of them were paralyzing traffic. Once in a while, they'd let cars, go through. That is what the Chavista governments have had to face, plus the support from the United States, plus the support of the church hierarchy, which has been completely in favor of the opposition, completely opposed to Chavez and now Maduro. And the media, they don't contextualize. They don't demonstrate that there's a relationship between this ongoing hostility of an opposition that employs legal, semi-legal, and illegal means to undermine the government and to create instability, and some of the decisions that are mistaken, that I would criticize, but regardless of what those errors are, there's a relationship between the errors and the situation that's going on the political and economic front. And they don't talk about the positive aspects of these governments, for the most part. Or they minimize the importance of the positive aspects. And I'll just briefly talk about some of them. With regard to the social programs, say the social programs have been successful and beneficial to the poor people because they distribute certain benefits, certain goods, certain services to the poor people. So those programs are good. But what should be emphasized is that what's important about the social programs is that they incorporate the poor people in the decision-making process. The official number is over 40,000 communal councils that were created by a law that was passed in 2006 that encouraged the creation of these. There was a proliferation of communal councils, and they receive funding. Firstly, they apply for funding on the basis of collective decision-making of assemblies in these communities, and then they solicit the funding, They oversee the carrying out of the public works projects. They insist on the hiring of workers from the community, electricians, plumbers, bricklayers, etc. And they report, you know, any discrepancy between the project, the blueprint, and the work that's actually being carried out. So this is a participation process which incorporates people, not only the working class, which always has organizational experience because these are people who belong to unions. There's a sense of discipline, both on the job as well as an organizational discipline. But in the case of the marginalized sectors of the population, these are people who work in the informal economy. They don't have steady work. They're not protected by labor legislation. You know, they're basically street peddlers, or they're people who work for small companies that are not registered, so they don't qualify for the benefits of labor legislation. This block of people represent approximately 50% of the population throughout Latin America. So Chavez, when he said, "I represent all people and my job is to improve the conditions of all Venezuelans, middle class, upper middle class, business people, but my emphasis and my priority goes with the poor people." The middle class people in Venezuela hated that, because here, you know, never before had a politician in power stated that the priority is with the poor people. And so this is one program that benefited not only the working class, but the marginalized sectors, which had never been taken into account before. Secondly, the privatization in the 1990s in Venezuela and throughout Latin America, but specifically in the case of Venezuela, the state control of the strategic sectors of the economy was a goal of the political parties going way back in time, going back to, you know, Acción Democrática, which was originally somewhat of a leftist party, anti-communist, but somewhat but on the left, which was progressive in the 1940s. That was one of their banners. State control of the strategic sectors of the economy. And that was incorporated in the Constitution of 1961, supported by COFEI, Acción Democrática, the Communist Party. They all supported that. Well, Chavez comes along and he puts that to practice. Now, what the opposition says is these state companies have been poorly run. That's true. There's no question about it in a lot of cases. But regardless, the fact that these companies were taken over, that in itself is important. That is a point of reference in debate now, so that the importance, the significance of that action stands out by itself, regardless of how those companies have been managed since then. It's something similar to the nationalization of oil, the oil industry, by Cárdenas, Lázaro Cárdenas, in 1938. Everybody knows in Mexico that Pemex has been poorly managed, but that doesn't detract from the importance of the nationalization of oil in 1938. And then finally, I'll just mention one last aspect, and that is foreign policy. And there's no downside with regard to foreign policy, as there is with economic policy and the social programs. You can talk about the pluses and minuses. But with regard to foreign policy, that has been progressive. Chavez announced when he was elected president in 1998 that he was going to promote this concept of a multipolar world. That meant that it was really a euphemism for anti-imperialism. He didn't use the term anti-imperialism until later. But multipolar world meant that it was a corrective to the unipolar world in which the United States controls everything. Well, the multipolar world meant that countries would organize in different blocks based on common interests, based on geography. So the Asians would have their blocks. The OPEC was another example of a block of nations. Venezuela began to play a more assertive role in OPEC, which traditionally Venezuela was kind of like a mediator between the Arab nations, who were the conservatives, and the more radical nations like Algeria, Iraq, Iran, which favored increasing the price of oil. And Venezuela was in the center, where with Chavez, that changed. Venezuela became very assertive. Venezuela had a lot to do with the increase in the price of oil, which had been quite depressed during the previous two decades. So that this was a concept of a multipolar world that Chavez promoted, and that had a lot to do with the creation of different organizations of Latin American unity, beginning with UNASUR, which took in the South American countries, which resolved conflicts in Bolivia in 2009, when there was a bloody confrontation as a result of the passage of the Constitution at the time of the previous, around that time. In Ecuador, with the attempted overthrow and perhaps assassination of Correa, this was a role that the United States had previously played. CELAC, which is an organization of Latin American unity, promoting unity and integration. ALBA, which began with an agreement between Fidel Castro and Chavez and took in Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and the two Caribbean nations. So that this is really a plus, that these progressive writers who locate themselves on the left side of the political spectrum don't point out. So I believe that in order to be successful in solidarity work, in opposition to the sanctions, and in opposition to a possible U.S. intervention in Venezuela, that it's necessary to point out the positive aspects, that it's not enough to say, well, I don't really care what's going on in Venezuela. My position is that the sanctions don't work, or that the sanctions violate international law, which they do, because the United Nations doesn't allow for unilateral sanctions. The sanctions against South Africa during the apartheid period were sanctions that were, you know, approved by the United Nations. But it's not enough to say that, because if you really believe that the Venezuelan government under Maduro is just as bad as the opposition, if you take a plague on both your houses approach, in which you say, that, well, they're both bad, the opposition and the government are equally bad, you're not going to sustain any effort. There are so many just causes out there that you're not going to really take much interest in this one. And the people that you're talking to, if they say, well, you know, Venezuela's a mess, it's all on account of Maduro, I mean, this is a narrative of the corporate media. And what are you going to say when people say, well, you know, I hope that these sanctions take effect because Maduro caused so much harm? The fact of the matter is that there are two responses to that. One is context. Sure, there's a difficult economic situation. And I would add, Maduro has made mistakes. But these sanctions have a lot to do with that. In addition to that, the Venezuelan opposition has been a disloyal opposition. You have the Chamber of Commerce who practically declared war on the Chavez government. Then they modified somewhat their narrative, but they've been hostile to the Chavez government and the Maduro government since then. So that's point number one. And point number two is that there have been breakthroughs. There have been successes. There have been positive aspects of the Chavez and Maduro government. And one of them is something that could be applied to the United States. The Constitution of Venezuela of 1999 stipulates that with enough signatures on a petition, people can call for referendums and recall elections at the national level. We have them in some states, here in Washington, I believe, certainly in California, in my state of Connecticut, but you don't have them at the national level. If we had referendums at the national level, I mean, we could have a referendum about maintaining troops in Afghanistan or a single-payer health program. And if we had recall elections, we could get rid of, we wouldn't have to wait until 2020. So that was in the Constitution, and that has been used. There have been referendums. One of them, the Chavistas lost in 2007. And there's also been a recall election that Chavez won in 2004. So that these are positive aspects of the Chavista governments that have to be brought out in any conversation with regard to the sanctions and the threat of military intervention. Thank you.
You were just listening to Steve Elner, the open veins of Venezuela. He spoke in Seattle. Steve Elner has taught economic history and political science in Venezuela for many years. His articles have appeared in major newspapers and journals. He's the author of Latin America's Radical Left. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Robin Kelly, Arjun Singh Sethi, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Medea Benjamin, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.